I'd like to make a request for, if it is feasible, for us to obtain a template when we prepare a presentation. We need to have an idea of the detail that is required in the presentation. From the questions that we are getting, it indicates to me that there is a certain level of detail that the portfolio committee requires. We can't just say we have arrested or fired so many people for corruption. The committee says, what has happened to them? We didn't think that, we have that information, but we didn't think that it should be part of the. If there is something like that, that would guide us, that when you come and state such such, we require this level of detail. Thank you.
Can actually respond to that. There would never be enough information brought to the portfolio committee. Now, in an event we ask a question, the details of which you do not have here, you can always indicate to the portfolio committee to say, we're going to give you this information after the meeting, because we can actually be asking for details that you necessarily do not have in the meeting. So there will never be adequate information that you make a presentation on, and therefore there are no questions that might need information that is not in the meeting. So in an event that happens, you indicate to the chairperson, and then you provide us with answers after the meeting in writing.
Thank you, Chairperson. Some of the questions I will request my colleagues to answer. On the first question of the Honourable Reverend Mishwe, I think the question related to when we conduct infrastructure inspections, do we also include the inspection of boom gates? And the question I think related to the issue of the abuse of security guards at some of these workstations that they work in. The answer is infrastructure assessments are conducted on applications of business applications. In other words, when a security company applies for a license to operate, prior to us granting the license, we actually go and inspect the offices, mainly of the security company. However, when we do site inspections, those are inspections which are most triggered by complaints that we receive from guards. We actually do inspect those sites, including the boom gates, if the guards are actually deployed at boom gates, and we conduct those investigations. Wherever we find contraventions of which actually relate to labor issues, we also do take action, and some of the matters we refer them to the Department of Labor for them to actually deal with if they are more labor related than actually the contravention of the code of conduct of the industry as such. Moving on to the issue about the question about the firearms, I will request my colleague actually to explain, because I think there was a number of questions regarding firearms, perhaps to explain in general and also to touch on some of the questions as well that were asked regarding the firearms.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair, members, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, my colleagues and ladies and gentlemen. With regard to the issue of firearms, I think it will be important for us, Sira, to explain our role in relation to the issuing of firearms or in relation to the application for firearms for our security businesses. The competence of the issuing of firearms in terms terms of the Firearms Control Act is with the South African police. Our role insofar as the applications are concerned is that the security business will apply for X number of firearms from the police. The police will therefore give us an inquiry, which inquiry we process within 48 hours and respond to the South African police regarding the status of the particular business that applies for firearms. For instance, if you apply for 10 firearms, the information that we give to SAPS will be whether that particular business is registered with us, whether the people who will be handling those firearms, that is now the security officers that will be the possessors of those particular firearms, are they registered with us? And over and above their registrations, are they linked to that business as the employees of that particular business? Is that number of security officers adequate for them to handle those firearms that are applied for? For instance, if a business applies for 10 firearms, we would expect that particular business, because firearms are used on a 24-hour basis, would expect that they must have a number of security officers who have got competence licenses, which are 20 or 25, in that they will be also relievers in that. So we'll confirm that, yes, they've got the number of people that they alleged would be the possessors of those firearms are employed, are linked to the business as employees of the particular business. We also ensure that the particular company has got no contraventions, and those people that will be possessing the firearms are vetted. They've got no criminal record as such. I think another then that is our role, is that we respond to those inquiries to confirm the status of the businesses. Then, based on that, the SAPS will then process those applications. So in that we will, that is the our contribution to the control of issuing of firearms. Because if, for instance, your business is new, does not have employees that can possess those firearms, obviously our response or recommendation to the SAPS will be that that particular business has got no infrastructure or capacity to handle the firearms in question. I think the first question was relating to how many the time and turnaround time for us in processing the application. I have said that we are not processing the applications per se, but we just respond to the inquiries to assist in the processing of the application, and we always we ensure that that is done within 48 hours, and then we send our response to the SAPS. They normally deliver them those inquiries physically to us, and they always come and collect them. I think they collect them twice in a week, which make it very easy for them to process the firearms. I think the other question was in relation to which businesses apply for firearms. Obvious new business, they don't have capacity to apply for firearms. The businesses that apply are the ones that are already in existence. That has been whose registration has been approved and who has been in the business. The new ones, because of the pre-requirement that I mentioned, the pre-requirement of the employees linked to them, is always the hindrance for them to have firearms. And not all sites that requires firearm. The loss of firearms, we will also respond to that in details when we are doing the writings, because all the loss of firearms are reported in terms of the Firearms Control Act with the police. they undergo vetting before they are employed. Vetting is categorized into two. There is a preliminary one, which is called the personal suitability check, which primarily look into one's citizenship. It also look into one's financial position. It also look into the qualification, and lastly, it also look into the into the criminal records. That is why the other member also comment. We also commented about the decline of in the new registration. It is because of those suitability checks that are controlled, and we also have this regulatory committee. Which regulatory committee scrutinize each and every application that make it not as easy as it used to be for anybody to enter the security industry without being properly checked, which resulted in the number of criminals that we have. The same thing is also taking place to our staff members. The personal suitability check is done at HR level, using all the agencies that have got capacity to check various things like your FSP for institutions for the financial position. With regards to criminal record, I can say that now we haven't had a situation whereby somebody with a criminal record could be able to enter. After that, a personal suitability check, which is a prerequisite step to a full vetting, whereby you complete now a 2204 form that is submitted to NIA. NIA also or the state security agents, over and above what I have mentioned, they add now where somebody's behaviors and patterns are being investigated. It is now the full investigation on the suitability of the person or on the risk to determine the risk of the particular individual, where they will go on visiting the people that we have mentioned and listed as your relatives, listed as people that you know who are not your relatives. They conduct interviews with them. They also went further, depending on the level of clearance that has been requested for vetting. They also conduct the lie detector, for instance, for all top secret. Lie detector is the first, is the last investigation that they conduct, and then one is issued with the security clearance. So 204 forms were sent, were issued to staff, and they have returned them, and we have currently sent them to SSA. I do have the report. People now try saying that I was visited. Somebody phoned a person that I gave as a reference. They asked them a lot. They asked them a whole lot of questions. It is a fairly long process, unfortunately, and which is not in our in our hands for its completion. But I can assure that the process is ongoing right now, because I had people that know, we thought these people have forgotten about us, because they will also go for those who have visited foreign countries. The agencies, I believe, they went as far as that end. But as I have said earlier on, that these questions will be fully canvassed in the written responses that we will submit. Thank you.
Madam Chair, he has just explained the process. I thought you would go. You say you process the application to the police. What happens is, say you have applied for this company for 10 firearms and the police have approved. Do you know that? Is that what? Are you informed about that? And because now also the question, what happens now? You go, like you said in page 23 of your report, you go and find that this company is nowhere to be found. This person has disappeared in the air. Do you report to the police? Because if say that company has already applied for the police for firearms and they've got firearms, what happened?
Thank you very much, Chair. We actually have a very good relationship with the South African Police Services, particularly the Central Firearm Registry, since 2007. YNC that we've had a number of engagements with them, including joint operations. We share information. We have access to their database. We are able to tell which security company have how many firearms, and if our information is not up to date, we actually go to the extent of requesting updated information from SAPS. And in cases where security companies have been withdrawn, are no longer operating, we actually inform them. I will actually give a breakdown later on of some of the numbers that we actually give to them. And that the regulatory subcommittee is sitting on a weekly basis. So the information and the decisions that are taken there are actually filtered through to the authorities. And I'm quite sure that they do act. In fact, in most cases where they act on these companies which are no longer compliant but they have firearms, they act with CIRA. We go into joint operation. I'm quite aware that a few weeks ago we had a number of quite similar joint operations where we went and arrested companies or owners who were in possession of firearms or who have actually abandoned the companies but are still in possession of firearms but have not reported to the authorities. Because in some cases, you'll find that they would then report, abandon or sell the companies to the next person who is not complying. In such instances, we actually also get into such operations with the police, if that answers the question. Thank you very much. If I were to continue, Madam Chair, with the questions, I would also ask my colleague to answer some of the financial questions. And let me perhaps continue with some of the questions that were asked by the Honourable Dina Kolobana. There was a question as to what happened to the cases that were investigated previously. I have two updates with regard to those cases. The one is the case of the former senior manager HR. The matter has gone to a stage where the trial has taken place. I'm quite aware that there is a number of witnesses that still have to testify. I know that three of our witnesses have already testified a few weeks ago on that matter. So the matter is on trial and it is pending completion. There is also another staff member who's still outstanding in terms of testimony. I'm not quite sure how many of them are still outstanding, but the matter is in the course in the Commercial Crimes Court. And the other matter is the matter of the Joburg lease. The matter of the Joburg lease, we are currently recovering our losses with regard to those lease. And the other one was the question of Mr. Mbodla. I do not have an update on that matter, but I will later on provide a recent update on where the matter is, if as we speak. The other question related to, I think the question of the vetting has been answered. The last two questions related to, I think, the financial questions, that I can also attempt to answer those questions. I think the question was what happens to the unallocated amounts and what happened to the generators. The generators we actually sold. We've actually removed those generators because we no longer at that stage required them. We've sold them and we've recovered part of the money, although not the original amount that were purchased for. And I think, Nick, can you come into the unallocated amounts? Because there is actually a detail of how we deal with those unallocated amounts, and I think it will be an extension of his presentation of how the unallocated amounts are dealt with.
I think, thank you, Chair. I think I just wanted to also deal with other matters that you also raised. There was a question on the debt collectors, who pays for the fees. The contract that we have with the debt collector is that they only get paid when they collect. So they would contract them for the entire database. So their process is they try to trace people, they make phone calls, they use tools that are used for tracing by debt collectors. They they don't collect, they don't get any money. So it is linked to how much they bring. They also, good thing about it is that they would not, they take longer to classify a debt as uncollectible, because then they are also losing out on the fee if they don't collect. Secondly, on the VAT registration process, there was also a question posed as well on that, whether we have completed with that. We have finally completed. We received a confirmation from SARS in January that everything relating to that VAT is finalized. On the unallocated monies, in 2009, the unallocated monies were gazetted as unclaimed monies by the authority, and majority of those amounts were not claimed, and therefore they were written off. As we move forward, we have now in place a process where unallocated monies relating to registrations, those relating to payments of debt, are regularly reconciled on a weekly basis, and listings are followed up on a daily basis by the finance department. So this process is ongoing. On top of the issue of unallocated monies, we also now in the issue about us using text messages to people. When a person when we send out text messages for demand of payment, we indicate to them what is the reference that they must use to make deposits, and that has been rising. Instead of using letters which are posted, so we're using at least more of technology, which is instant, and people to a point where when people go to the bank, they just look at their text message and use that reference instead of referring to a document. Just to on the generators as well, the generators were sold on a competitive bidding process where we recovered 471,000 for the sale of those generators, with the exception of one which are still using at office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the other question related to the how many of the active companies, I think you mentioned the number of 8,828. The 8,828 is actually the number of active registered businesses. Yes. As compared to a bigger amount of plus minus 25,000, which would then be the total number of on our total number of companies on our database, of which the balance would either be withdrawn and no longer active in the industry. The only time it is no longer active is when that license has been withdrawn or has been suspended or is on voluntary suspension. So the number that 8,000 relate actually to the active ones, including the ones that are actually suspended and on voluntary suspension, excluding the withdrawn ones.
So you have about, you say, 25,000 businesses on the books, but 8,828 are active. Am I correct?
Okay,
fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me move to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, sorry, Madam Chair, but I just want to take us a little bit back. There was a question from the chair which was very interesting, because it's the same question that was asked by the CFO one Saturday when we had a fun walk in 4702. The issue of different firearms that the security officers can carry. Yes, no, the CFO, I must say, was very scared to say that the security officers can also carry the R5 rifles. The security businesses, they don't, some of the firearms, the types that they are issued with, are not the types that are issued to our security forces. For instance, there are firearms types that can only be possessed by the SAPS and the Army. However, you will find the replica of those firearms that resembles, for instance, the R5 rifle. The members of the public and private persons are not allowed to carry an R5 rifle. However, there is a firearm that resembles the R5, which is called an LM5. LM5, the difference with the R5 is the functioning. And some of the security, the firearms that can be issued to security companies are those firearms that have got limited capacity in terms of function. The LM5, for instance, which is used by the security officers that you see, that resembles the R5, it does not have all the functions. It only has the single function and the double action function, which is not at the rate of the ones that are carried by the security forces, the SAPS and the SNDF. The R5, on the other hand, it has got the single function, it has got the double function, and it has got full automatic. The one full automatic that has been disabled on the LM5, which is the replica of the R5 rifle. Thank you.
I can imagine, you know, these honest members of the portfolio committee, they are so confused. The single, the automatic, they have used. I have no clue to what you're talking about. However, what you're saying is that they're not the same. And how different they are, I think those are details which we probably will not understand. Some of us have never handled a firearm, you can imagine, with all the terms that you're using. However, we appreciating the fact that you're saying they might look the same, however, they don't function the same and they have different names. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Honourable Liketo asked a question regarding the appointment of the Audit Committee. What criteria was used during the appointment? The positions for the Audit Committee members were advertised in the national newspaper with the criteria that we require the appointment of Audit Committee members who have the background in financial environment, accounting and risk, as well as forensic services and IT. And a number of applications were received, and candidates were shortlisted, and the shortlisted candidates were interviewed by the council, and appointments were made thereafter. And that is the criteria that was used. The other question is the redeployment of inspectors. What is the vacancy rate currently as a result of that redeployment of inspectors? The total vacancy rate is 15%. I think that accounts for the entire organization. It's standing at 15% as we speak. And there was also, I think, a question of the write-off. Why was the write-off so huge, and who are the people that actually were responsible? I'm not sure about the detail of the people which we can provide at a later stage. However, I will ask perhaps the Deputy Director of Finance to explain the process that follows the write-off, and perhaps that's what we will understand, why is it so huge and so on. And for accounting purposes as well, Nick.
In this current financial year, we've separated the debt into two. There is outstanding amounts that were the debt that is emanating from individuals being security officers coming from the legacy debt, where and then there is also debt from businesses. Now, on the security officers, we took a view in this current financial year, in the previous current financial that we are reporting here. The write-offs were only for security officers, individuals. And if you look at our basis or motivation for that write-off was to say this debt was inherited. But if you look at the current the legislation, it does not require payment of fees from security officers that are unemployed, whereas the previous was requiring such payment. So in the current regime, you are only, if you're a security officer, you're only paying for your annual fees when you are employed, and it's done through a payroll deduction by your employer. So to write off, we quantified the amount, it was 75.5 million, which includes interest and penalties over those number of years that the debt was in the books. For us, it was uneconomical to pursue such debt because the majority of those people are unemployed, they're individuals. The part of the debt was also prescribed as well because it is legacy debt. The cost of recovery obviously did not warrant further action in that one would have to look at the cost, how collectible is the debt and how much resources do you want to put into such a debt. And some secretaries were also built incorrectly. So that portion of the debt then was written off. We then concentrated on the business one. The business one then we said we cannot just write off. We need to send it to a process of debt collection, which is based on that 18% or collection fee. As they're going through the process, they use those track and tracing device technology where they find information from credit bureaus and so forth and addresses of those persons. Now, every week they give an update to say, these are the accounts that we looked at. We are of the opinion that we cannot trace these people or these people are not economically active. Therefore, we cannot pursue this debt. And then they give us a detail. But when we look at the debt, we said we didn't want just to write off. We need to do a process which will say, in the event that a business was owing and we write off, that particular director or member of that CC must also be withdrawn for not honoring his obligation as a member of the CC or as a security officer, registered security officer. Therefore, the withdrawal will be on the business and it will also be on the individual so that the person cannot participate in the industry because you failed to honor your obligation as a professional in the industry. And that is the process where we are in this current financial year going to, in December, we would have written off those amounts and withdrawn the company's business and those individuals. On the question of what steps are we taking to reduce the debt, if you look at our debt, the debt has been growing because of interest and penalties over the years of the debt that was not in the first instance collectible. Therefore, when we write off the debt, we're going to stop those interest and penalties that are piling up on that old debt to a point where we'll be left with clean book, which we can identify the people and so forth. But the process of writing off and cleaning our books is the one that is needs to happen first for us to say we are starting on a clean slate and we move forward.
May I ask Nick?
Yes, thanks so much. Your answer is very detailed. You are talking about security officers. Are you talking to your employees? I'm not sure. But that amount is very huge. Unless you say later to me, this is for business, this is for our security officers. I don't know who are you referring to by security officers. Thanks.
Thank you. The security officers are employees, which is in this current financial year, we wrote off 75.5 million. The businesses is the table that I indicated, the other one with 145 million. That is the book that is going through a process which is rigorous and satisfying ourselves that all steps have been exhausted to collect that debt, and therefore we can write off and withdraw those companies.
I would like to request Deputy Director of Finance also to respond to the question that was asked by the Honourable Member here, where he says, you say that you have an agreement with you, which you entered with between yourself and a company that was doing cash in transit, but you're saying that there was no loss incurred to the tune of 1 million. Could you respond to that? Why do we say?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think there's two. Just to make a distinction between irregular expenditure and full expenditure. On slide 28 and the following. signed, therefore leading to a non-compliance in terms of PFMA. However, the service was rendered, and we did pay for that service. But we did not lose, because we received the service, we received the benefit. I think that is just an issue of classification, because irregularity is not necessarily a loss to the entity. It's just that we did not comply with a PFMA requirement. And I think just to add, Chair, there was a question posed which we skipped by Honorable Mushe about the slides 27 and 30, where the amounts were different. Where he was saying the amounts are different. If you look on the slide 27, refers to the status of the debtor's book as at the end of March 2011, at year end, showing 5,537 accounts that are untraceable. On slide 30, this slide is current information, because we were doing an action plan after the audit. On the second row, we talk of 6,708 accounts which are untraceable. This is because of passage of time, because from March to September, the tax collectors were busy tracing and so forth. So the amount that they could, the accounts that they classified as untraceable between March and September grew from 5,500 to 6,700.
To deal with the question, I think it was asked by the Honorable Greg. He said the deficit has increased, operating expenses have increased. What are you doing about reducing the operational costs? Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. I think if you look at the costing of CIRA, we are saying we have said in our strategic plan to say we need to increase capacity. The issue is not that there is wastage in the authority. We are talking about 47 inspectors, of which we must grow the inspectors. So we are not necessarily going to cut expenditure. We need to grow, and growth means we need we will be spending in human resources and so forth. And going back to 2011, the year 2011 was a year where we cleaned the books and show a true picture. And hence, the Auditor General's opinion is saying the state of affairs, financial state of affairs, I don't have a problem with them. It's an unqualified audit opinion. Because we've went to clean the asset register, and hence you saw the depreciation rising from 2 million to 5.5 million. You've seen accounts that were not collectible being written off, and those are the accounting entries that went through into the books in the process of cleaning the financial status of the company. Now, if you look at the rest of expenditure, we've managed to try to contain reasonably. But when we put in growth, the expenditure must grow, and the process that are in place for us is to say, for us to grow, we need more income. And then we are in the process where we've submitted to the minister to say, these are the proposals for us to increase the annual fees for this current financial year, which will be effective in this quarter.
Through you, Chair, the Honorable Van Wyk wanted to answer this portion because I think it falls into my place. Council is now functioning as it should. Council is functioning as it should in that we do have a quorum. We are three. Mr. Nisi, who was part of the council, which made the council number come to about four, has been redeployed. I understand that he is out of the country deployed in a diplomatic capacity. The two gentlemen that we need to fill the number of council members to five, I explained at the start that requirement by cabinet that we should have on paper something which says these people have security clearance. We didn't know, we're not aware of that. We thought if you work for NIA, you must have security clearance. But the cabinet wants to see it on paper. I think that is going to be cleared quite easily because I've spoken to DG Maketu about that, and he has promised to facilitate that. And the other gentleman comes from Home Affairs, who we consider to be a very valuable ally of CIRA in the work that we are doing. There is no problem there. It's just that, again, we are going to have to obtain written proof that he also has security clearance. When that happens, the council will have 5 members, and that will be the full quota of the required number of council members by the CIRA Act. Yes, ma'am.
I mean, it's welcome that there will be a full number of council members, but I think my question is more about whether the council feels that it is fulfilling its strategic leadership role, whether it's done that now, that it's comfortable that is happening. I think that's more the question than a number question. I mean, while we appreciate, although being a female, I would have hoped one of the other two vacant positions would have been filled by females, especially since you get more and more female security officers as well. But it's more quality question. Are we getting strategic leadership from the council? That's more than what I'm asking.
Sorry, Chair, if I could just follow up on that question. I think the answer is probably twofold. And I want to go back to when we appointed at initial stages. The state the institution was in was very close and, in fact, synonymous with dysfunctional. When the word CIRA was mentioned, it was, what are we getting ourselves into? And that is when we started off as a new council. It meant that we met very often, sometimes twice a month, and even for periods longer and consistently, and just getting it from a basis where there was no strategic plans, no documents, no policies, nothing. The level of confidence is indicated by the fact that the council now can meet as a regular council once a quarter and even less, because the systems are in place, the executive is well functioning, there's great confidence that council has that the business of the day is being managed. I think that is an indication of confidence, the extent to which we're able to fulfill the role as intended in the Act. When we started off, the minister gave us a brief and he said, we are not a council of a bakery. The importance of CIRA cannot be overestimated. So I want to link that. Yes, that there is confidence, and I think it's more than confidence, it's also a pride, because as indicated by some members, we didn't think it was possible to turn it around, and it means the basis from which we are moving to a roadmap that we have set would get us closer to the actual role that CIRA is intended to play. And that is a question that I would like to answer, because I think it's been tabled by the Honourable Member Van Wyk, who asked the question as to what is the status of the private security in South Africa and what is our response in relation to our mandate in as far as giving an indication of the status of CIRA. We would have loved to have given you a full analysis of the state of private security in South Africa today. That cannot happen unless we clean up CIRA first, unless the confidence in CIRA as an authority can be established in order to give confidence in the industry and to the public out there that when you put facts and figures and analysis on the table, that our credibility is without question. And that is the part that we have done. So hopefully as we move forward, that we could then take the position of the authority from giving us the mandate in the basic sense to one in a greater strategic sense. And in fact, we'd like to see a situation where when we talk about security provisioning and the regulatory arm, which is the part that we deal with, in addition to what the police does, that we can have a sense of the status of security of the public, because that is the contribution that we make. And if CIRA is able to leverage off our ability to access and exercise and interpret the information that would give us that estimate of where things are at play in as far as the security of citizens are concerned. That is the path that we have to move towards. That is our trajectory. That is our roadmap. But we ask the honourable members to bear with us. We've made significant strides in stabilising the institution and the authority, and then to move further to a resource that would be able to provide the information that would be required. So that does give us a constant to the eye at the moment.
Thanks, Shamal. My last question. I'm very much interested in this matter, Mr. Nkege. You know, you have just mentioned huge amounts that you write off, and this becomes a recurring problem. And people cannot make their own plan and all of these things. But you're not telling me this provision that allows you, I don't know for what reasons, you give your employees money that you write off so often. But I'm saying it's recurring. And I'm not at peace myself with that provision. Unless you tell me, not now, can you look into that matter? How do you get that? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think we will expand. I think in our written response, we'll put that as one of our responses in writing to give more detail to those write-offs, if the committee allows us to do so.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to address a question that was asked by the Honourable George. The level of infiltration by criminal elements into the private security industry. It's a constant headache, ma'am. So the question is very relevant. What I would like to point out to the honorable member is that there are people that were able to screen off prior to their entry into the private security industry. That CIRA is able to do by checking IDs and all sorts of things with the help of Home Affairs and NAME. But there are people who become criminals after they have entered. Now they are security guards. We don't have anything on them. And then they use their positions as security officers to commit criminal acts. When they do that, it becomes a police matter. With the cooperation we have with the police, they then say to us, so and so, this company has so many people who are being arrested for doing whatever. Then we look into it, and then the conclusion of the case then enables us to deregister these people. So maybe the problem of criminal elements in our industry will never end, because we screen them before they enter. Once they have entered, they then become criminals.
Thank you, Madam. Can I answer the question on the foreign nationals? Is related to the screening specifically? Just following up. I did not quite get.
No, my question. Thank you, Jefferson. My question that how many cases have possibly been identified where it is brought by foreign nationals for investigation? That was the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Previously, I do not have the exact figure, but
identified plus minus about 700 and something cases, which we suspect that needs to be investigated for fraud, specifically identity fraud by foreign nationals. That number might have since come down as we actually go deeper and deeper into the applications. We then realize that some of these applications actually did qualify the criteria then. I do not, as I said, I do not have the exact number. We can provide the exact number at a later stage again. Okay. Madam Chair, I have actually ticked quite a lot of questions that have been answered, and it's quite also.
I'm about the staff one, the figures that are not adding up, staff figures.
About the number of employees. Madam Chair,
can I just explain? In your annual report, your reference to staff members differ. If you add up the figures, I can give you the exact detail when we leave, but your figures differ. So your figures are not adding up. So can you give us the correct?
Can we have the exact numbers?
Can
I relate to there's two numbers that you normally get when you deal with the numbers of staff members. You'll have the number of funded positions, and then you'll have the number of positions. I'm not sure which one the honourable member is speaking to. I've got specifically, if we can look at this. Yes, please.
In the table on page 35 of the annual report, it adds up to 204 and not 203 as stated. The annual report table on page 35. It adds up to 204, not 203 as stated. The table which sets out the composition of staff divisions adds up to 207. The total number of staff in finance and administration 49 is incorrectly stated as 52, and when all the totals were added, the figure of 207 is arrived at. So I can continue. Our research department did quite a lot of work on this, so I can give you this afterwards, and if you prefer to answer the question to us in writing, then let's do so, but I can give you this.
I think we'd rather answer the question in writing to explain the numbers, Madam Chair.
There was a question on the skills audit. What was the outcome of that? What do you mean by the skills audit?
That question also requires a written response because we have a very detailed report with regard to the skills audit outcome. Madam Chair, most of the questions we can provide them in writing.
Thank you very much. We will appreciate that. We definitely do not have the liberty to give you a long time. Today. Yes, if we can get the written responses by Tuesday next week, we will appreciate that very much. On all questions that you've not responded to. Chairperson, you want to make a few closing remarks before I close the meeting?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We would like to express our appreciation for the quality of the questions that were fielded by the Honourable Members in that. The questions, in my view, were without malice. They were probing, and that, in our view, helps us to look at our side mirrors. We might be thinking we're doing the right things, but the coming here assists us in finding out what we are not reporting correctly. That's why I talked about the template. Also, we feel that we are within
within a family, people who want to assist us to succeed. And I would like to thank the members and you, Madam Chair, for being frank with us. Where you are not happy with our performance, you state it. The questions that you ask probe our weaknesses, and we'll be stronger in the end rather than weaker. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chairperson of the Council. Let me thank you for appearing before us, but also for sharing with us the information that is in your annual report. 2008-2009, this entity received a disclaimer opinion from the Auditor General. It had been a trend before that financial year. Correctly so, it indeed was an entity that was almost dysfunctional. The minister intervened by appointing a ministerial investigative task team on the 3rd of March 2009 with specific objectives, and of course on the 1st of January 2010 he appointed the council. After that intervention by the minister, for the first time, 2009-10, this entity received a qualified audit opinion with indeed quite a number of serious issues that were raised by the Auditor General. We met with the entity on the 2nd of November to allow it to present its annual report. And the annual report was revealing nothing but an entity in crisis and an entity that was actually collapsing. However, in that meeting, we committed ourselves that we will actually be making close follow-up on the working of CERA. And indeed, the following year, on the 3rd of March, we met CERA, where CERA presented its turnaround strategy. When you did that, we said at the portfolio committee, we are cautiously optimistic of what you will be doing or capable of doing. We also said that you'll have to appear before the portfolio committee to present your improved strat plan as well as the annual performance plan, which indeed happened on the 31st of May this year. In that meeting, we said as the portfolio committee, we will indeed be monitoring CERA quite closely because we think you have an important role to play in this country if you want to talk about the security of the country. You have an important role to play. We were happy about it when we therefore got the news that CERA ultimately has received an unqualified audit opinion from the Auditor General. We thought it is indeed, and we still believe that it's an indication that you are working towards achieving something for the people of this country. There are matters that have been raised by the Auditor General. As a matter of fact, out of the issues that the Auditor General has raised, green, yellow, and red, you have received, I think, 7 green and about 31 yellow. One thing that is, or 32 yellow, one thing that is pleasing, though, is that you do not have a red, which means you are working towards, you need to improve and move towards receiving more yellow. I mean more green. I just want also to say that there are quite a number of issues that are in your report and raised by the Auditor General in your financial statement as well that CERA needs to improve. However, I must say that going back to where we we are today, we do believe that things have happened. We as the portfolio committee will continue to monitor the work of CIRA quite closely. It has been quite some time now that you have been saying you're going to bring to Parliament the Private Security Industry Regulatory Amendment Act. And we have been saying as the portfolio committee we are awaiting that act to come before us so that it can actually be processed. We believe that you need to be strengthened through legislation as well. We do believe that. And whatever that you have achieved so far, if that is not strengthened through a legislation that must come before us so that we can process it, ensuring that you are stronger and you have a legislation arm that make it possible for you or makes it possible for you to force whoever to do or to comply with the law, you will therefore, you may probably go back to where you are. We do not want that. In that regard, I really want to appreciate the work that the council, but also CIRA is doing in this regard. And we will indeed be following up on what you are doing. We've had quite a number of meetings that have indicated, and we'll probably continue to have meetings because we definitely want to monitor closely what you are doing. We leave this house, we go to or this room, we go outside of this, we see members who are supposed to be your members. And some of the things that we see practically happening are not that good and they're not pleasing us at all. And it is in that spirit that we will monitor the work of CIRA. We are looking forward to a day where the CIRA Amendment Act will be tabled before Parliament and this committee will process it. We're looking forward to that. And we want to believe that it's going to happen in our lifetime, that is, during this term. Otherwise, it will be unfortunate if we close or we end this term having not processed this legislation. We believe it is important. You need that legislative arm that will strengthen you so that you can actually do your work properly and according to the law, while understanding that there is an existing law, but it does need to be strengthened and it does need to be amended. Thank you very much. I just want again to say what I said in the morning, that as we do welcome the appointment of the acting national commissioner, and we do welcome the appointment of Ntlantla Mkhwanazi. Personally, I'm happy that he comes from an area that probably can bring what is called discipline and command and control to SAPS. I want to believe that we're going to work with him and we're going to allow him to find his footing within SAPS and move on. We will do that as the portfolio committee, as we did with other national commissioners, as we did with the national commissioner Bekicele, and we'll move on to hold him accountable as we normally do. We paid for it, I always say, and we're not volunteering. And I just wanted to say that. Thank you very much for attending this meeting, and thank you very much for the contributions. Tuesday next week. I wanted to add one other issue that I'm requesting you to add in your responses, because I'm not very sure whether you did submit this one. We had requested for a list of suspended or terminated companies. And I'm not sure whether you did give us this information or you did not give us that information. So we're requesting you to please provide us with that information. We ask for that information on the 31st of May. List of suspended or terminated companies, because we want to know when we go to these areas as to whether those companies are not or are still operating. So So we're requesting that you include that list in the questions that you may forward to us. To members of the portfolio committee, we have been granted a permission to meet tomorrow to look, if possible, to adopt the Gauteng report and some minutes that are outstanding. And we will ask for yet another day or afternoon to then adopt the UK-Canada report. And the venue for our meeting tomorrow is E444 New Wing, and time is 9:30. Thank you very much, and this meeting is adjourned.